We'll hear arguments first this morning in Regan against taxation with representation of Washington. Mr. Solicitor General, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Congress has provided two general types of tax relief, either or both of which may be available to certain kinds of organizations. First, Section 501C exempts the income of about two dozen different types of organizations from taxation on that income. And second, Section 170 entitles the donors to a smaller number of 501C organizations, including both veterans groups and also groups qualifying under 501C3, to deduct their contributions. One of the qualifications for 501c3 status, and therefore both tax exemption and also donor contribution deductibility, is that no substantial part of the entity's activity consists of attempts to influence legislation. The proposed activities of the appellee, which has unsuccessfully sought recognition as a 501c3 organization, will consist principally of attempts to influence legislation. It attacks the constitutionality of the scheme that I've just described on two grounds. The first is that withholding tax-exempt status from 501c3 or any other organizations which lobby is a violation of a First Amendment right. And the second is that since Congress has afforded tax-exempt status to veterans organizations which lobby, but not to 501c3 organizations which lobby, its equal protection rights have been denied. The in-bank Court of Appeals unanimously held, and we agree, that the appellee's First Amendment argument is foreclosed by this Court's unanimous holding in Camerano versus the United States that the Constitution does not require Congress to subsidize First Amendment activity. With respect to equal protection, the Court of Appeals further observed, and I'm quoting, that taxation also has a weak case solely in terms of equal protection, because of Congress's vast leeway under the Constitution to classify the recipients of its benefits and to favor some groups over others. Nevertheless, the Court of Appeals ruled that a heightened standard of equal protection scrutiny was applicable and that it was infringed in this case because First Amendment rights were affected even though they had not been infringed. The Court remanded to the District Court with instructions to cure the unequal treatment which it found by one of two alternatives.
Well, did the Court of Appeals use that rather obscure phrase that you just used, that the First Amendment rights were affected but not infringed?
Well, it first held, Justice Rehnquist, that under Camerano they had not been violated. I think that is more my characterization, but I think that's the only fair way that the Court of Appeals opinion can be read, is because of the effect on First Amendment rights. The Court identified as the most logical remedy option to impose the lobbying restriction on veterans organizations, none of which is a party to this litigation. It also identified another alternative, judicially enlarging the congressional list of exempt organizations to include the 501c3s, which the Court observed correctly in our view, might open a Pandora's box of woes and abuse. In our view, the underpinning of the Court of Appeals holding has to be that Congress has violated the Equal Protection Clause, even though there is no direct infringement of a First Amendment right, if government treats different groups of people in different ways and the differential treatment comes to rest on a First Amendment or other fundamental right interest. And that is the combination of circumstances that brings the equal protection guarantee into play. Whatever appeal that argument might have had if we were at the dawning of its day in court, I submit that it comes too late because it has already been considered and rejected by this Court, which has held on at least three separate occasions that government subsidization of one group but not another, even where the fundamental rights of the non-subsidized group will be affected, violates no constitutional guarantee. Buckley versus Vallejo, for example, upheld provisions of the Internal Revenue Code, which granted public funds to the candidates of major parties, but not minor parties. There was clearly unequal treatment, and there was an arguable impact on First Amendment values. Similarly, in Maher versus Roe and Harris versus McRae, congressional statutes providing Medicaid funds for indigent live births, but prohibiting such funds for abortions, were attacked on the same grounds advanced here, namely that the impact of the different treatment came to rest on a fundamental constitutional right of the disfavored group, namely the right to decide whether or not to have an abortion.
But the court in those cases left open a situation, which I take it you're going to comment on.
Yes. But the difference in treatment in those cases was undeniable, and the effect was on a fundamental constitutional right. Nevertheless, the court held that there was no equal protection violation because there is a basic difference between direct state interference with a protected activity and state encouragement of an alternative activity consonant with legislative policy. Now, the difference between those cases and the instant case. In our view, there are two that are relevant, and both of them make this case a stronger case for constitutionality than in Harris and Maher. The first difference is that in those cases, the two things that were treated differently were mutually preclusive competitors. That is to say, the statutorily preferred event, which was birth, necessarily precluded the constitutionally protected abortion decision by the indigent person, so that to whatever extent funding encourages childbirth, abortion is necessarily inhibited. And here, by contrast, subsidizing veterans groups has no automatic detrimental effect on charitable groups. The second difference, and in my view the more important one, is that the classification in this case is part of our national tax laws. This court has made it very clear that for equal protection purposes, income tax cases are in a class by themselves. The Internal Revenue Code is perhaps without peer in its intricacy, its detail, and its sheer length. By their very nature, most income tax provisions classify. Their function is to identify under what circumstances the burden of different groups in our society, or the share of the national tax burden borne by different groups, is to be either increased or decreased. In carrying out this function, Congress necessarily treats different people in different ways, and many of those differences have an arguable impact on a fundamental right. Importing heightened scrutiny as the test governing the constitutionality of that kind of a complex and interrelated statutory construct would seriously damage the certainty and the predictability that should be characteristic of our national tax laws. Aside from everything else that ought to go into a fair tax system, it is important that taxpayers know with as much certainty as possible what their obligations are. That certainty value is enhanced by the rational basis equal protection test because of the likelihood that it assures that the congressional judgment will in fact survive. It is diminished by, correspondingly, by a test of heightened scrutiny. Look at the matter from Congress's standpoint. It is probable that the time will never come when Congress does not have before it some proposal for change in the income tax laws. Congress's ability to respond to new developments, new information, new understanding is a difficult enough task under any circumstances. It should not be rendered even more burdensome by increasing the likelihood that the judgments that Congress makes will be turned around by the courts. Take this case, for example. Section 501C consists of 22 categories. It should come as no surprise to anyone that the Court of Appeals found that two of those categories resulted in a difference in treatment to their occupants. Of course there are differences in treatment. If Congress had not intended differences in treatment, there would not be 22 categories. The point is that the entire code, and not just these 22 categories, essentially consists of differences in treatment. And that, I submit, is why this court has consistently accorded great deference to congressional line drawing in the income tax area. and is repeatedly stated, and most recently in San Antonio versus Rodriguez, that in taxation, even more than in other fields, legislatures possess the greatest freedom in classification. That brings me to the final point, and that is whether the distinction between lobbying by veterans groups on the one hand and lobbying by 501c3 organizations on the other satisfies this deferential standard. Quite clearly it does. Prior to 1934, there were no express statutory limitations on lobbying by exempt organizations. Congress was concerned, however, in 1934, that the deductibility of contributions to organizations otherwise classified as religious, charitable, or educational could effectively translate into the public financing of private propagandizing on a range of subjects limited only by the donor's whim. And the attractiveness of that abuse increased with the donor's wealth. It was a concern that was first expressed by Judge Hand for a unanimous Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in 1930 in a case called Slee versus Commissioner. And as this court observed in Camarano, the 1934 Act made explicit the conclusion derived by Judge Hand in 1930 in Slee. Very simply, there are differences between veterans organizations on the one hand and 501c3 organizations on the other that are highly pertinent to this concern, first expressed by Judge Hand in 1930 and then ratified by Congress in 1934. In the first place, there are quantitative differences. The number of veterans organizations is only a fraction of the total number of the 501c3 groups. And the 501c3s collect about 1,500 times as much in contributions as do the veterans groups. Even more important, these organizations structurally, by the way, by virtue of the way that they are chartered by Congress and in fact carry out their operations, do not offer the opportunities for abuse identified by Judge Hand in 1930 and by Congress in 1934. The veterans organizations were formed...
Generally?
Yes.
What if Congress, instead of giving the veterans organizations a break in the tax statute, had simply appropriated $5 million to each of them? Do you think that would be challengeable in court at all?
I do not.
This really isn't much different.
I think it is not very much different. And I think this court has made that very clear, and it brings into play another body of doctrine that is also determinative in this case.
Has not Congress, over a period of years, granted a great many benefits to veterans? Which
precisely.
Are not granted to
and
others?
They've been consistently upheld. The most recent that I'm aware of is Johnson v. Robeson, in which this court upheld the differential treatment insofar as veterans' benefits were concerned to conscientious objectors and to those who... The benefits went to those who had seen actual combat duty and not to, and the challenge was to a conscientious objector. The point is, as set forth in our brief, the figures that have been released by the government demonstrating that 2 out of 5 of every American citizen is a beneficiary in one way or another of veterans legislation that has been passed by Congress. And just as is the case with the income tax laws, this court has also clarified that there is a great deal of deference to which Congress is entitled in determining the benefits to which those persons are entitled who have made a great sacrifice for the benefit of this country, both in terms of interrupting their civilian pursuits and also in terms of risking their life and their health.
Mr. Solicitor General, may I go back for a moment to your comment that there are only two differences between the abortion cases, the funding case, and this case. Do you think the abortion cases would have been decided the same way if the people on welfare who wanted abortions not only didn't have them financed by the government, but if they had an abortion, they then lost their welfare benefits? Here, as I understand it, the 501c3 organization loses its exemption if it engages in lobbying.
This is the same question that I raised that you haven't yet answered.
Yes, and I plan to do so right now. I think it is not at all clear to me that Maher and Harris would have been decided the same way if the consequence had been to lose welfare benefits. There are a couple for a couple of reasons. One is that I think another principle that comes into play is whether Congress has acted in such a way as to solve the problem that it was immediately before it. And at least a very strong argument could be made that that was simply sweeping too broadly with the remedy. In this instance, by contrast, the problem that Congress has identified is the problem of the 501c3 with unidentifiable size of membership and type of membership, and the potential that it offers for a small number of wealthy individuals to have their expression of public views, their lobbying, if you will, subsidized by the government. And in this instance, Congress has not swept any more broadly than is necessary to solve the particular problem.
Well, of course, I suppose that you say they're wealthy persons because they're rich enough to contribute to a charity. But by hypothesis, I suppose, the lobbying is for a charitable purpose, which the government recognizes as in the general public interest, or otherwise it wouldn't give them the tax exemption in the first place.
Yes, and in SLEA, of course, the problem was attacked by defining what is meant by charitable. And what Judge Hand did in that case was to uphold the government's position that it isn't really charitable if it's being used for lobbying purposes. Now, what this really does is to make administratively more feasible to administer by eliminating the need on a case-to-case basis to determine whether or not it is charitable. But in any event, I think there is this distinction between your abortion hypothetical and the case at Barn. Of course, the other distinction is the other two distinctions are the rules applicable to veterans' cases and applicable to tax cases.
Well, General Lee, I suppose the appellee could set up a separate corporation to do its lobbying and preserve the 50C3 status for everything else.
The Court of Appeals, in fact, pointed that out, and that is
well. Do you agree with that?
Well, they can. It is not. Yes, they can set up a separate 501c4. Now, they will tell you, I think, in fairness.
Well, wouldn't the IRS be the first to move in and say these are twin corporations and hence they'll lose their
exemption? Depends on what the relationship is between them. And that's the disadvantage, Justice Blackmun, as you correctly point out, that it is not that clear. In the event that there is an attempted subsidy by the 501c3 group of the 501c4, then yes. That is not permitted. And as a consequence, that is not a complete answer.
It certainly is not so easy an answer.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I have found that it is less easy than the Court of Appeals implied, in fact.
Generally, I'm not quite certain what happens to an organization, a 501c3 organization, which does lobby. Did you say that it actually lost its exemption?
Yes. That is correct.
Yeah, is that? I thought perhaps it just lost its right to have contributions deductible. Did it actually lose it?
That's right. It's demonstrated by this case. There was an application made for 501c3 status for a determination under Section 7428 that this was a 501c3 organization. They described 501c3 status is. The status that entitles initially to income tax exemption. And then Section 170, in turn, keys into 501c3 status for purposes of deductibility. It was determined not to be a 501c3 entity because of its lobbying and therefore loses both the deductibility and also the tax exemption turn on it.
General Lee, one of the amicus briefs argued there was no jurisdiction under Section 7428 to make a constitutional attack on the validity of tax statutes. I know in a footnote in your reply brief you indicated disagreement, but it seemed that was worth a comment at least, because that statute seems to be set up to provide only review by the Commissioner of Administrative Matters and not to raise constitutional issues.
It certainly can be interpreted in that way, Justice O'Connor. We submit that in that respect it is susceptible of interpretation either way. The crucial language is that the court on one of these 7428 reviews may make a declaration with respect to such initial qualification or continuing qualification. Now, 2 points. One is that in our view, qualification is broad enough to include the constitutional issue. And the second is that particularly where you have some ambiguities, I think we certainly have here, that it is proper to look to Congress's purpose. And in this case, the congressional purpose is rather clear. It was to undo the inequity that resulted as a result of the decisions in Bob Jones versus Simon, the 1974 decision, the companion case that came down the same day in Americans United, that the only way one of these 501c3 or other types of organizations could obtain a determination as to whether they did or did not qualify was to either have a refund suit in the district court or to go into the tax court. Now, since the objective was to provide one simple remedy for determination of 501c3 status vel non, it would be a bit anomalous to say that Congress intended to split those out and require constitutional determinations through the old and more difficult process. And for that reason, we don't think that 7428 precludes the constitutional issue.
One other question, if I may. Do you think that this Court's recent holding in has anything to do with this case?
Well, I think it helps us to an extent. It certainly is not as on point as Camarena, but nevertheless, it does show the flexibility, other things being equal, insofar as the judgment of the policymaking bodies is concerned. So, yes, Perry does support us.
The flexibility of the First Amendment.
Well, the ability of that amendment to make accommodation in the light of other policies, and in this case, it reinforces at least Camarano's holding that when you have an arguable effect, as you do in this case, on a First Amendment interest, that comes about because of an income tax classification, that you judge the case as an income tax case and you defer to Congress's judgment in that respect. And indeed, I know of no instance in which this Court has ever applied anything other than the rational basis test in an equal protection income tax case.
May I ask one other question?
Yes.
Forgetting for the moment the equal protection phase of the case, because I think it's part of your position that all charitable organizations are not fungible. Veterans are different from some.
Right.
Do you think your First Amendment argument is equally strong regardless of the character of the organization? Let's say it's Aid to the Blind or something, and you have the group just tries to promote legislation that will help the blind.
I do, Justice Stevens. You can argue that Camarena was distinguishable, but I think that the principle that was established in that case carries through to Congress can make the decision as to which kinds of First Amendment activity it wants to subsidize and which kinds it does not, which really brings it back to an equal protection.
But you've acknowledged, I think, that there's more than subsidy at issue. It isn't just deducting the portion of the income that is spent on lobbying. It requires them to lose their entire exemption.
That is correct. And it's different from Camarena in that respect. And my answer is twofold. The first is that in both instances, Congress went no further than it needed to go in order to cure the problem that I identified. And the second is that
But here, in effect, my Aid to the Blind organization is losing a very valuable exemption because it engages in a protected activity. That's all it does. I assume that the lobbying is first protected by the First Amendment.
Yes, but it's just as true here as it was in Buckley and in Maher and in McRae and in those last two cases. The Court said it's not as though the government was saying you can't have an abortion.
No, but in none of those cases did the claimant lose anything. He just wasn't allowed to finance it.
That's true. And there is that distinction, as we have observed. And as I say, my answer to it is
there any other case in which merely because a party engaged in protected activity protected by the First Amendment that the government was allowed to take something away from it?
So far as I know, at least in that respect, you'll be making new law in this case. But I submit to you that the principle from which that new law ought to be made has been declared by Camarena, and that is that it is, after all, a matter of Congress's determining how certain activities shall be financed and how valuable those activities are to Congress, and I would like to save the rest of the
General Lee, I take it you stand by your, I think it's in your reply brief, you suggest that the First Amendment issue isn't here at all.
That is correct.
It isn't properly here.
That is correct, for reasons that are set forth in that footnote. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Sims.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In this case, Appley challenges the severe penalty which is imposed on public charities if they choose to engage in substantial lobbying as a means of promoting their charitable purposes. Let me emphasize at this point that the case only involves public charities, that is, organizations under Section 501c3, which are not private foundations. Private foundations are groups that, as defined in the Tax Reform Act of 1969 and the IRS regulations implementing that statute, are groups where there's not seen to be enough accountability to the public to assure that the organization will act in the same way that it would if it were accountable to the public. And the Tax Reform Act of 1969 virtually precludes lobbying by private foundations. And we think that's important because when the Solicitor General was referring to what he believes Congress was concerned about in putting into effect the restriction that we're challenging here, he's talking about the possibility that a charity might really not be acting for charitable purposes in particular circumstances, that maybe a particular individual would be attempting to manipulate a charity or perhaps even set up a charity in order to serve private concerns. Well, under the Tax Reform Act of 1969, Congress has already defined the group of organizations where there could be a legitimate concern that there's not enough public accountability. And Congress has acted independently, and that issue is not before the Court in this case. Another point that I think is worth making with regard to the risk that a public charity might lobby in order to promote some private interest, we'd like to point out that, first of all, lobbying, to the extent there is any risk in that regard, lobbying isn't any different than any of the other activities that a charity might engage in. That is, I suppose one could say that there's some risk that a charity might engage in litigation or pamphleting or publishing of educational books in order to promote some private interest. So the argument made by the Solicitor General doesn't really hone in specifically on the lobbying issue. As we've emphasized in our brief, there are also a number of independent restrictions that aren't challenged in this case that would prevent a public charity from using its resources for lobbying or for any other activity on behalf of private interests. Under the IRS regulations, in order to qualify in the first place for a 501c3 exemption, you have to be operating for the public good rather than for a private good.
Well, are you suggesting, Mr. Sims, that the IRS could make an evaluation in each case, each exempt taxpayer, and say, well, you're 33 1/3% over the line here, so we'll cut off 33 1/3% of your exemption?
Your Honor, if Congress were to pass that alternative statute, that would deal with our argument about the disproportionate penalty. If to the extent that there were a penalty on lobbying that was tied in amount to the amount of excessive lobbying beyond whatever Congress said was appropriate, the disproportionate aspect of the current penalty would be eliminated. We don't believe that that would make the statute constitutional because you're still left with the core question that comes up in any First Amendment case. Is, first of all, what is the congressional interest that is being promoted by the restriction? And secondly, has Congress, in developing the particulars of the restriction, done it in as narrow and as minimally restrictive a way as possible?
Mr. Sims, you suggested a moment ago that there was a distinction to be made between lobbying for a private interest or in the public interest. Is that done by Congress or by the IRS?
That's part of Section 501c3, Your Honor, in that no group can qualify under 501c3 if there's going to be any inurement to the benefit of a private individual. In addition, the statute itself says that any charity has to be organized and operated exclusively for exempt purposes.
So it's kind of the common law concept of inuring to the private good as opposed to public.
A common law concept that then has been incorporated in the statute, and that's also reflected in the regulations. And so to the extent that one can discuss a concern about the possibility that lobbying might be directed to a private end, that's already dealt with in a number of other ways in the statute and in the regulations and, as you've indicated, in the common law of charities and trusts.
Well, the truth of the matter is, if you set up a trust or anything for your own benefit, that's not charity.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Well, I don't understand this public and private. What is a private charity?
A private foundation
is a private charity.
I'm not sure that there is such a
thing. Well, you keep saying there's a difference between a public and a private.
Your Honor, the terminology that we've been using in our brief and that I've been trying to use today is public charity, which is not a statutory term of art, but it's a term that is used often to refer to charities, that is 501c3 groups, which are not private foundations. And then private foundations are independently defined in Section 509 of the Internal Revenue Code. But the point I was making in this regard is that to the extent that it's said that this restriction on lobbying is necessary in order to prevent charities from engaging in activities improperly on behalf of private interests, that concern is already dealt with in other provisions of the provisions in the code, specifically the no inurement provision in Section 501c3 and also the operated and organized exclusively for exempt purposes provision.
What would the Ford Foundation be?
Pardon, Your Honor?
What would the Ford Foundation be, a public or a private?
I'm not sure. I suspect it's probably a private foundation.
What are you talking about if you don't know? I'm trying to find out what is the line between a public and a private charity?
A private foundation is defined in Section 509 in terms of the sources of income. So
I'm talking about charity, not foundation.
Well, a private foundation under Section 509 is a subcategory of Section 501c3 charities.
Simply because it's named by an individual?
No, because the sources of revenue for that particular subcategory of charitable organization comes primarily from a small number of sources rather than from the general public. And so in enacting the Tax Reform Act in 1969, Congress indicated that there wasn't the same discipline of public support for those groups that there is for public charities. But this case only involves public charities.
Is there any issue like this in the case, as far as you know?
Involving?
I mean, this distinction. I didn't hear the.
Well, the distinction is only relevant to the extent that it addresses the concern expressed about the diversion of charitable resources to private benefits. It's relevant in that regard. As this Court has noted in the Bob Jones case, the denial of a tax deduction tax exemption under Section 501c3 can have disastrous consequences for a charity. It means, in effect, that many contributors simply will not make contributions to the organization, and it may very well jeopardize the organization's ability to exist.
Mr. Sims, you agree with the Solicitor General, I take it, that an organization, a 501c3 organization lobbying loses its exemption.
First of all, it's an organization is permitted to lobby up to the level of substantiality under Section 501c3. If an organization has already qualified under 501c3 and it lobbies to an excessive amount, it does lose its exemption altogether.
Could it then qualify for a 501c4?
It could, up until the Tax Reform Act of 1976. One of the changes that was made in 1976 was to created this election mechanism under Section 501h, and the statute also says that if an organization is eligible to elect under Section 501h, and all charities are under 501c3 are eligible to elect except churches and except private foundations, so any other public charity could. If you are eligible to elect under 501h, Then if you lose your 501c3 status because of excessive lobbying, then you can't qualify for C4 status. That was a change that was made in 1976. The Solicitor General, in referring to the Appley organization, said that the organization would primarily engage in lobbying. We would like to clarify that in two respects, in that first of all of the activities engaged in by taxation must be directed to charitable ends. We think that the distinction between lobbying as a means and lobbying as some ultimate end is one that is reflected at a number of places in the government's brief. We never have argued that lobbying per se is a charitable purpose. We emphasize that under the law of trust and under the common law and under the IRS regulations, lobbying is a proper means of promoting a charitable purpose. And the reason that taxation couldn't qualify for a Section 501c3 tax exemption in this case is because it couldn't say ahead of time that it would not engage in substantial lobbying. We have not indicated that lobbying is going to be the only activity carried on by the organization. And in fact, the exemption application, which is in the record in this case, indicates that there are a number of other litigation and educational activities that will be carried on by the organization. But lobbying engaged in by taxation will be exclusively a means of promoting a charitable end. And to the extent that the Solicitor General relies on SLEE for the proposition that lobbying is not a proper purpose for promoting a charitable end, and that somehow the use of that means, rather than some other means of promoting a charitable purpose, renders the purpose uncharitable, we suggest that even if SLEE was properly decided in 1930, and that may be a close question, certainly the law since then has developed very strongly in the direction and that lobbying is a proper means of promoting a charitable purpose. The Restatement of Trust says it. All the standard treatises on trust state it. And, in fact, the IRS regulations say that charitable, which is the umbrella term that's used in the regulations in Section 501c3, is used in its generally accepted legal sense. And, in fact, in permitting charities to lobby up to the level of substantiality, Congress has implicitly recognized that lobbying is a proper means of promoting a charitable purpose. The government relies very heavily on three cases in addition. Well, Camarano obviously is the bedrock for the government's position, and then there are the three more recent cases of Buckley, Mayer, and Harris. I'll speak briefly about Camarano, which has already been discussed at some length in the exchanges between the Solicitor General and the Court. We do want to emphasize that the penalty that's imposed on a group, on a charity which engages in substantial lobbying, is totally disproportionate to the amount of lobbying that's engaged in. And that makes a big difference in comparing this case to Camarano. In Camarano, there was a complete correspondence between the amount of the lobbying activity engaged in by the taxpayer and the tax consequences. The taxpayer simply couldn't deduct the amount of money that was spent on lobbying. In the case of a charitable group under Section 501c3, the group loses its right to receive any tax-deductible contributions. And as I mentioned before, if it has been an electing organization or eligible to elect under 501H, you can't even qualify for a 501c4.
So you really are challenging on First Amendment grounds the whole lobbying qualification in 501c3.
Your Honor, we are challenging both. We're challenging the restriction itself, mm-hmm. and the more particular issue before the Court is the disparity in treatment between veterans groups and charities.
I understand that. Do you think there's any merit in the suggestion that the First Amendment issue is not properly here at all?
Your Honor, we believe that the issue is here. We, out of caution, filed a cross appeal raising specifically the First Amendment issue. The Court mm-hmm. hasn't acted on that. Mm-hmm. We believe that because this is an appeal under Section 1252, though, the whole case comes up to this Court. And the Court has indicated that in the past, although it hasn't specifically addressed this issue. We certainly think that the issue is before the Court if the Court chooses to grant review in the cross-petition.
And what about your qualification to argue it as an appellee?
Pardon, Your Honor.
Or as a, suppose you had never filed the cross appeal. Would you still be?
Well, we believe, I think there is something to the government's argument that the relief would be different, and if it were a, if it weren't a 1252 case, if it were a more conventional case, I think we would have difficulty because we, in effect, if we prevail on the First Amendment issue, we would get relief that would be broader than the relief we got in the Court of Appeals.
Thanks.
On Camarano, we do think that the penalty issue is very important, that there's not the correspondence here that there was in the Camarano case. Secondly, of course, this case does have the equal protection issue. The specific holding of Camarano was that a non-discriminatory, even-handed denial of deductibility did not violate the First Amendment. Of course, here we don't have a non-discriminatory, even-handed, across-the-board denial of tax benefits based on lobbying. We have a situation in which certain groups, the veterans organizations, are allowed to lobby without limitation in support of their charitable purposes, and the 501c3 groups must choose between the tax benefits of the statute and their freedom to engage in lobbying as a means of promoting their charitable purposes.
Do you suggest that Congress cannot distinguish between an organization formed, let us say, to help the handicapped and others of that kind, where there is a great deal of public activity in the area, but these activities supplemented. Now, you say Congress can't distinguish and have a more generous attitude toward a foundation or an exempt taxpayer assisting the handicapped, the blind, the hard of hearing, crippled.
Your Honor,
it must be absolutely uniform across the board?
No, Your Honor, we've never claimed that. And in fact, we wouldn't claim that there's a constitution.
But you're claiming it now with respect to veterans. You're saying that veterans are being treated more favorably than others, therefore it must fall.
The problem is not the favorable treatment. The problem is that the favorable treatment is specifically directed to the area of First Amendment rights.
I'm addressing that. More favorable treatment with respect to lobbying, which everyone has a right to do, of course.
Your Honor, we don't believe that there can be more favorable treatment of that sort unless it can meet the First Amendment standard of review. That is, unless the congressional purpose in providing the preferred treatment is compelling, and unless the restriction is crafted in such a way that there's a minimal restriction on First Amendment rights. Buckley may be a good example in that respect. I think that nobody can question the court's the logic of the Buckley decision when it says that there can't be a requirement that anybody who wants to run for president gets $20 million. The court pointed out that would encourage a multiplicity of parties, frivolous candidacies, and in effect it would undermine the very purposes for the statutory benefit scheme, which was to change the way that elections were financed for the good, not to create greater chaos. And in Buckley, the distinction that was made between existing parties and new parties was integral to the system of public financing of elections. But if there had been a statute that said that the Republicans or the Democrats can get funding but the other major party can't, that would have been suspect under the Equal Protection Clause. And we think that that's essentially what's involved here. It's a discrimination among charities based on their identities, and it's specifically directed to the exercise of First Amendment rights, and it's not directed to the legitimate objectives that Congress certainly can implement if it chooses to do so, to, for example, provide various other sorts of benefits to veterans. There are educational benefits, reemployment benefits, medical benefits and lots of others. And there's no problem with providing those in recognition of veteran service to the country.
Mr. Sin, supposing the cure to the problem you're now addressing was to just say, well, okay, we won't let the veterans we won't let them lobby either without losing it. What good would that do your client?
It wouldn't, Your Honor, and we don't think that's the appropriate relief. Judge Mikva.
It would remove the illegality of which you are now reporting to describe.
That's right. It would not solve the equal protection argument that we're making, but it would solve the equal protection disparity. As we've noted in our brief, we're not aware of any situation in which this court has found an equal protection violation and then remedied it by saying, well, we'll take something away from the parties who aren't before the court rather than giving something to the party who is. And that, in some cases, involved very substantial drain on the federal treasury. For example, when you've got a Social Security case in which widows can get a certain benefit and widowers can, and there's a challenge to it, and it's determined that that's an equal protection violation, well, that if you're going to provide benefits to everyone, that means additional money is drawn down from the Treasury. Nonetheless, this Court in those cases, if an equal protection violation is found, has uniformly extended the benefit.
So you don't defend the Court of Appeals' result in this respect?
No, and in fact, no one does, as far as I know. The veterans groups, obviously, don't prefer the remedy suggested by Judge Mikva.
Well, then don't you have the jurisdictional problem that you're basically arguing for relief as an appellee that was different than that granted by the Court of Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor. So everything I said before with regard to the First Amendment issue would be equally applicable to this, except to the extent that I think this Court has in the past sometimes regarded a remedy
question.
Except with
respect to your cross-appeal. Did you raise that in your cross-appeal?
Yes. The two questions were the First Amendment issue and the remedy issue. But I think that this Court in the past has sometimes reached the remedy issue in an equal protection case as an integral part of the whole case without necessarily granting review independently. And the other thing we'd emphasize in that regard is that this case does involve First Amendment rights. And in, for example, the picketing cases, I don't think it's ever been seriously suggested that if there's an equal protection violation because some people can picket at a particular location and other people can't, that the proper solution is to prevent everyone from picketing.
But can you think of any case in which this Court has granted someone a benefit under the Internal Revenue Code which Congress didn't choose to grant them because of an equal protection argument?
I'm not aware of any tax case that does that, Your Honor.
The one case of this Court which says that on an equal protection argument, you cannot solve it by taking away from the other one. Cumming against the Board of Education, 1914.
Well, I'm glad to hear about it. Justice Rehnquist, I'm reminded that although it's not a federal tax case, the Spicer case did involve a tax benefit that had been denied.
That was a California
It was, right, it was a state case, so it's not directly on point, but it may be analogous.
While we're talking about remedy, may I ask you what you would suggest is the proper, if we put to one side for a moment the equal protection problem and just concentrate on the First Amendment and your argument that there's a penalty here, how do you cure that? I can understand curing it in the Caminero facts where you just allow a deduction for the amount expended, but how can you get a partially qualify as a 501c3 organization?
Your Honor, we think that the right way to cure it would be to pass a statute that if there are particular abuses that are a concern relating to lobbying, such as improper lobbying for private purposes, that the statute
well,
should
no,
be directed to those.
Supposing Congress decides that if 60% of your revenue is spent in lobbying and they don't want to subsidize the lobbying portion of your work. Now, under the abortion cases, would you agree they could do that if they could figure out administratively a way just to avoid financing the lobby?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because in this case
— Well, then you really are not relying on the penalty aspect of the case.
Well, we're relying on both. I think that both of those arguments help us. If you take the penalty argument out with regard to the abortion cases still involved a situation where the court found that there were two competing interests each of which was valid. There was the interest in preserving the life of the fetus, and there was the freedom of the potential mother to have an abortion. And the court found, at one point, I think the court says in Harris against McRae, that in applying the equal protection analysis, that an abortion is not like any other medical procedure. It can't be compared because the interest of preserving life is involved. In this case, the kind of discrimination that's involved is among speakers and among
Well, but my question is on the assumption that we're not troubled by we say we agree with the government that veterans are different from aid to the blind because taking away their exemption won't really help you, and we're just concerned with with your First Amendment issue on its own bottom. Is there any way to remedy the problem insofar as we might see a defect in the scheme because it penalizes you whenever you engage in substantial lobbying by taking away your entire exemption? Is there any remedy that would be addressed to that alleged defect in the scheme?
I haven't developed a specific one. I'm sure it could be done I don't think anybody in this litigation has put forward a specific proposal that would accomplish it.
Is that the government must subsidize the lobbying?
No, Your Honor.
To be consistent with the First Amendment.
No, our argument is that if the government...
Well, then what limited relief could you, besides that, could you have? I mean, how could the government, as Justice Stevens asks, how could the government meet your objection without subsidizing lobbying?
Well, I think Justice Stevens is asking whether a remedy could be developed that would prevent subsidy of lobbying, but still allow deductibility for other charitable activities. But the point that I wanted to make is that we think that we believe that the question is not whether Congress has to subsidize lobbying, but whether Congress, having chosen to allow these tax benefits to charitable groups which are engaging in socially beneficial activity, and to allow those groups to litigate and to publish books and to carry on all sorts of other activities.
So you must keep the exemption going for people who lobby for charitable purposes, right?
That the Congress, if it's going to single out that category of First Amendment activity.
So yes, you do. So your position is then
that
lobbying must be allowed by charitable organizations. That's without losing any exemption. That's your position.
Yes, that is our position.
And must, to that extent, be subsidized.
Unless Congress can explain in a way that would meet this Court's First Amendment analysis.
Well, what if their explanation is we see the problem, but we can't figure out administratively any way to avoid the we have the two extremes. We've either got to take your exemption away completely, or we've got to subsidize the lobbying. We don't want to do the latter, so we've just, as a practical matter, we've adopted the only feasible solution. And you haven't suggested there is a feasible solution in between.
Well, the Tax Reform Act of 1969 shows that when Congress does want to specifically address an identified problem, it can do it. And that's exactly what it did with regard to the perceived abuses and activities by private foundations.
But you have already conceded, I thought, in discussion, that Congress can favor some entities like the veterans, the handicapped, over others. Did I misunderstand you?
No, Your Honor, that certainly is right. But I believe, qualify that by saying that when the discrimination involves the exercise of First Amendment rights, Congress has to meet the very stringent requirements that are applicable when First Amendment rights are regulated. That is, Congress has to explain why some groups are being given enhanced First Amendment rights and others aren't, and it has to show that the restriction has been developed to minimally intrude on the exercise of First Amendment rights.
But when the blind, the halt, and the maimed and veterans engage in lobbying, it's to advance a broad public interest that has been recognized in other settings by Congress, has it not?
Yes, Your Honor, and the blind, the lame, and the halt, and their representatives are the very people that are being denied the right to lobby in pursuit of their charitable interests. So we have an amicus brief that's been filed in this case by almost two dozen charitable groups of just the sort you've referred to, the Red Cross and the American Heart Association and the Girl Scouts.
But they don't have a case before the court for us to make an evaluation of their problem, do they?
No, but all their activities are limited by the same statute that limits taxation's activities. And like taxation, like all 501c3 groups, they are limited to carrying out charitable purposes under Section 501c3, and they're all limited with regard to the extent that they can use one particular means, lobbying, in order to accomplish their charitable purposes. And in the amicus brief, those charities have indicated that restriction prevents them from carrying out their activities in support of the sick and the injured and the needy, and that they could do those jobs better if they could lobby. And in fact, they've indicated that in some cases, lobbying may be the only way to accomplish a charitable goal, such as, for example, in the Mental Health Association mentions that In many places, there are archaic statutes that are on the books regarding the mentally handicapped or the mentally ill, and it's only by working for a revision of those statutes at the local or the state or the national level that they can accomplish their purposes. So we don't think that there's any basis for saying that there's an inconsistency between lobbying and the proper charitable purposes that 501c3 organizations promote.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Solicitor General?
No, Mr. Chief Justice, unless the court has some questions.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...